Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. What a joy. I'm facing Linda Barry, and, well, we're here to talk about everything, but in particular about her newest book from Drawn and Quarterly, Making Comics. It's a book that began, in a way, as an exercise book, yes, but she couldn't resist. She decorated it. She put in pictures that 3- and 4-year-olds have drawn. She watches the comic book develop from the monsters that 3- and 4-year-olds make to the gradual availability of composition books. She tells you how to divide the page in half and quarters into triangular segments, what kinds of pens and pencils to use, when to use the ruler, when not to, and never to look at your phone when you're making a comic. How did you evolve your rules for making comics?
I teach at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. And I teach a class called Making Comics. So this book is a book that I tried to make that would sort of reproduce what it was like to be in that class for a semester. But mainly, it's a book for people who gave up drawing. You know, most people give up on drawing at about the age of 8 or 9 when they realize they can't draw a nose or hands. And it's like, I'm washed up. That's it. It's over for me. And so most people are still living with a decision they made about themselves when they were 8 or 9. And the wonderful thing about comics is comics leaps over that problem. If you try to think of Charlie Brown with a hyper-realistic nose or hands, it'd be kind of horrifying, right? But for comics, it's just a little mark. So all those shapes that we make when we make the alphabet or our numerals, 1 through 0, are all you need to be able to make comics.
Yes, we learn to draw when we're drawing letters. Mm-hmm. We draw the letters of our name. We don't write them. We draw them.
That's right.
And when we start doodling around our names, putting flowers over the eyes, making the C's cornucopias of who knows what, mm-hmm. and it's good not to know what.
Yeah, exactly. I believe there's some part of you that does know. And there's a milestone that every human being goes through. It's when the baby discovers its own hand. And if you actually go on YouTube and type in baby discovers own hand, it's a human milestone. But when you watch it, it's so amazing because you'll see the baby suddenly so interested in this hand and the hand starts to move around like, watch me. And all of a sudden you realize there are two. The baby's discovering its hand, but the hand is discovering the baby. The hand's discovering there's some part of itself that wants to pay attention. And I feel when I look at that, I'm seeing the very beginning of making art.
The first place you go when you're with your youngest group is to ask them to draw a monster.
Mm-hmm.
And often as not, they'll have made a big circle,
mm-hmm.
and then they'll make a circle inside it, and they'll make a monster inside a monster.
Yeah.
It seems as if the impulse to draw is the impulse, pardon my big word, to concatenate. They're, you know, connecting.
Yeah.
Monster and monster and tooth and claw, and they can't stop.
And eating and being eaten. Those are two very human ideas. And also, you know, the main thing is it tends to make people very, very happy. That's the thing that I find in the classes. So that monster exercise is one anybody can do. And you just start out by, it's good if you have two people. So you both make a quick scribble, then you trade papers, then you set a timer for 3 minutes or 2 minutes and turn that scribble into a monster. But here's what most people don't know they can do. Most people can figure out they can do that, right? So pretend you and I did that. You'd have a monster in front of you. And I'd say, now I want you to draw that monster's parents. Which two monsters had to get together to make that one? Everyone can do it. And then I'll say, now let's look at that monster. Draw that monster as a toddler with an older sibling. Everyone can do it. And then you can look at those monsters' parents and you can say, draw the grandparents. And very quickly, within 20 minutes, you can make an entire family.
They have a story, a chronicle.
They arrive with a disposition toward the world. You can tell who's the bully of the group. I mean, it might not be the same answer for everybody, but suddenly all these things that are sort of story generators and attractors show up. So I think about this as the kind of drawing that goes not from your head to your hand, but up your hand and into your head, moving that way too.
You do the simple thing, like giving lists of instructions of how to draw a frame on the paper inside which the comic takes place.
Mm-hmm. The place for an experience is inside that frame.
And every day you write your name at the top of the paper and the date on the page. You sit down, you arrive promptly. This doesn't have to be in a classroom.
Right.
This can be just your agreement, your contract with yourself. I'm going to open that part of myself that can draw and always could and let it go.
And that's one of the reasons why all the exercises let you know how long they're going to take. So they'll say this is 40 minutes or this is 20 minutes. Because in a funny way, people might be horrified or scared of their drawing. But if they know this is only going to last 20 minutes, it's as if some part of them, it's like the dog park or something, some little dog part of you gets to run around for 20 minutes free.
Well, it's great because there are some things that you tell people not to spend more than 90 seconds.
Right.
Just get the face done. Scribble it.
Yeah.
Scribble it fast.
Fast.
And you tell them, don't stop writing. Don't stop if you finish before 90 seconds. Keep on going. The point is stay in motion.
Stay in motion.
Keep it going.
It's that physics thing, right? A body in motion stays in motion.
Now tell me, you don't know me, but can I draw?
Absolutely. Of course you can. You're drawing while you're talking to me and you're making gestures with your hands.
Oh, always.
Yeah.
Always.
That's drawing. It's exactly the same thing. And I had a brilliant teacher at the Evergreen State College. Her name's Marilyn Frasca. And one time I was looking at one of my drawings and I was just, it's crazy how artists can be so mean to their work. And I was going, oh, I don't really like this drawing. I don't know how I feel about it. And she said, it's none of your business. And it was the most revelatory moment because I realized my work has a life apart from me. And it may have an equal right to exist once it's out of my body. And that really struck me, that once this drawing is out of my body and it's there on the page, no matter what I think about it, it doesn't change what's there necessarily. So I wanted to get a way of working to get people as fast as I could to get past how they felt about the work and get it back into it being a place for an experience.
I'm talking to Linda Barry about her new book, Making Comics. It's a how-to-do book, really.
Mm-hmm.
It's really very nicely decorated, but it is a how-to-do book. What is a character jam?
Oh, a character jam is such a fun exercise. So in the class, everybody has 10 index cards. And at the bottom of the index card, I'll say, name a kind of person. So you might write socialite. And then you do it to the next card. I'll say, name an occupation. So maybe you'll say nurse. So we'll fill those 10 cards with styles of people, occupations, or I'll say the name of a high school teacher that you had, Mrs. Maida. And then we start to pass the paper. So you pass the entire stack and suddenly you get this card. You don't know what it's about to be, but suddenly you realize it says park ranger and you have 2.5 minutes to draw a park ranger. So you do that, then you put it under the stack and everybody passes it. So in no time at all, you can suddenly get 400 characters in a room. And each of those characters arrives again with a disposition toward the world and a mood. And you can take that drawing that was done by another person, someone in the class, and then I can say, okay, let's draw a park. There's, you're drawing a park ranger. Draw a park ranger as a teenager. Now draw a park ranger. So you can start to take that one little drawing and expand it and make a whole life in no time at all.
So these attitudes are not ones you put there.
They're
ones you discover there.
Exactly.
That you see there. You just draw, and suddenly if you go learn how to look better, you'll see the nature of the character.
Absolutely.
Now, you've got to tell me something, Linda. I just met you, although I've been wanting to for a very long time. You're obviously terrifically likable. Is it a requirement for a teacher to have your rapture, your vibrancy?
Well, I think it's always a good idea to be likable, but I genuinely love this work, and I love my students, and I love their drawings. And one of the things I get accused of is the crazier a drawing is, the more gnarly it looks, the more I love it. But I really am passionate about the work they do, and it's not an intellectual kind of passion, it's full body passion. When I'm seeing work that really moves me, I make an involuntary sound like, oh, or ooh, or mah. It's as if some part of me just makes this noise. And that's what it's like in class when I'm with my students and get to see their work.
Another person who went among the young, and he taught them poetry, it was Kenneth Koch.
Yeah.
He wrote a book called Wishes, Lies, and Dreams.
One of my favorite books in the whole world.
It's a fabulous book. It's a fabulous book because the truth of the matter is children can't write poetry, but they can describe scary monsters. If their description of scary monsters is funny and lively and wild and surprising, it's a poem. But it's a Kenneth Koch poem, and that's the problem with the book. He teaches people to write Kenneth Koch poems, and there are all sorts of other poems to write. Do you teach people to make Linda Barry books?
You know what? I think that's a really good point, and I may. I just may. Although the one thing I can say about my students' work is that no one's work looks like anyone else's. We work in unison. I run a really tight ship in my class.
And I could tell.
I mean, I do. I determine where people are going to sit. I mean, I'm really, really, because I feel like if I take care of all those things, then there's room for this little wild part to come out and have a little corral to run around in. But so the one thing I can say is that none of my students' work looks alike. And the subject matter is highly varied. But I do think that the approach to not thinking that you have to plot everything out before you do it is something that people take to heart. You don't necessarily need or should. I don't think you should plot stuff out. If you don't have enough control and you're drawing someone and you happen to draw the eyebrows so that they're pointing down and it makes the character look angry, even though you didn't intend for the character to look angry, but suddenly you can use that line and it will start to move your story in a way that you wouldn't have necessarily planned for it to go.
I think, too, that sometimes if you learn from a teacher the teacher's methods, so what?
Mm-hmm.
It's true. There's no teacher who's going to destroy the student if the teacher is open and wise and funny and vibrant the way you are.
and that you love that you love your students' work and that you love them. I think love's a part of it. I think it's something we don't talk about very much anymore, but I think love is a big part of it.
Oh, can you tell me about that kind of love?
Well, I'm somebody who comes from a really difficult family. So that for me, the love that I found was being born into a world that is filled with characters waiting for those of us who, this is what I think is so amazing about the human world, is you may not have the people that you need in your house. They are waiting for you in fiction and in well, in nonfiction too, but there are all these characters that are actually waiting for you to become attached to them and fall in love with them. Music's the same thing. You think early on, you think about books that changed your life, that saved your life, and your only response to that is love. You know, I mean, it's not abstract at all. It's this. It's like somebody who keeps you from going over a cliff.
Comics used to be vilified, and they're not literature, and they're not. But it doesn't. I think it doesn't matter. I have a pile of your books in front of me, and they're books. You open them like books. You read them like books. You discover your way through them. It doesn't matter. One actually is a novel called The Good Times Are Killing Me, and it's hilarious. But the 100 Demons, what did you call it?
Autobifictionalography.
Autobifictionalography?
Autobifictionalography. You know, it's the idealized way that you can remember something or remember your life. For instance, a situation where somebody may say something that offends you, and you leave, and you're driving home, and you suddenly realize what you wish you had said. I think the French call it, what do they call it? L'esprit d'escalier, the spirit of the stairs as you're walking away. And this idea that you don't just go, oh, I wish I said that. What we do is we reimagine the entire scene again. We know exactly where that scene begins. And this time we go through in our minds, we say that thing we wish we had said. We feel some satisfaction. So what do? We play it over and over and over again. So I always say that by the time you get home and tell your friends, call your friends and tell them that's what you did say, it's not really a lie. That's autobifictionalography.
Well, what I love, you see, of course, is the beginning of the following sentence. She was at the library. It's referring to the Linda Barry character. Mm-hmm. Well, she was at the library. That's the best place to be. When she first read about a painting exercise called 100 Demons, it was the first example she saw was painted by a Zen monk in the 16th century. That our impulses are ancient.
Yes.
That what you do in this book is invoke demons, not just physical demons like lice, but human demons, the demons who inhabit your life and creep you out for the rest of your life until you write 100 demons and bring them all into an auditorium together and let them all make as much noise as they want, because won't that be not scary, but entertaining.
Yeah, yeah. And some kind of balancing. It's just balance. It's a way of balancing things. And the demons can even be ideas. You know, one of the ideas that you'll hear over and over again is how resilient children are. You'll hear it all the time. Horrible things happen to kids, and then the newsman will say, well, children are really resilient. And I always think, why do people say this? There's all kinds of evidence to the contrary. But I do think that what makes us resilient is fiction, is characters, our books, that this world that we arrive into that's here to just hold us. It's astonishing. You know, one of the things I love to ask my students is I say, well, you know who Scrooge is? And they go, yeah. And I say, so Scrooge was here before you were born. Scrooge is going to be here after you're dead. Where is Scrooge? They go, what do you mean? I said, well, Scrooge is with Medusa, is with Spider-Man. Where are they? And they go, what do you mean? I said, well, let's put it this way. What would it take to get rid of them? So we can put these characters in the image world. They're there. I mean, it's amazing to think how that's what's resilient, is the image world is resilient. Unless a culture is wiped out, these characters persist. You know, I was able to find that exercise from the 16th century because it persists through time intact. Poetry moves through time intact. How? How is it that I can recite an Emily Dickinson poem in 2019 while I'm by myself just waiting somewhere, you know, and still get something new out of it?
One night when I was asleep, I dreamt an Emily Dickinson poem. It's her poem about the train. I love to see it lap the miles, she says. But In my dream, it was, I love to see it lap the milk. And it was a poem about a cat. It was a cat train that came.
The cat train of thought.
we have to be open to the possibility that the possibilities within us are worth exploring.
Yes.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. You're listening to Bookworm from the studios of KCRW. I'm talking with Linda Barry about her new book, Making Comics. We'll continue after this short break. I'm Michael Silverblatt. This is Bookworm, and I'm talking with Linda Barry about her new book, Making Comics. I loved this, and I want to know, where do I get that special blue pencil that's not too waxy? It's something that when you photostat, these blue lines will disappear.
Yeah, it's very old school cartooning. It's called non-photo blue, and this particular one is made in Austria. It's a Stadler is the name of the brand. There are other non-photo blue pencils. You know, computers have pretty much made these unnecessary. But there are a lot of cartoonists who prefer to do your penciling in this very pale blue, and then you ink over it. The reason that that was used was because the blue disappears when it's photographed in black and white. You didn't have to erase it, so you never had to compromise your blacks or worry about smearing them. A lot of cartoonists, Chris Ware actually is one of the people who still uses non-photo blue. I have my students use it. It looks like thinking to me. It looks like thinking and dreaming. So you can make a very loose sketch in this non-photo blue and sort of gaze into it and then start to see your character or see those lines. And then those are the ones you go over in black.
Well, you've spoken in one of these books about gazing.
Mm-hmm.
That gazing is one of those what you dream about what you've just doodled.
Mm-hmm.
And if you dream well, and everyone does, you see, the other thing that people forget is that we're awake when we sleep and we dream when we're awake.
Yes.
We dream all 24 hours and we're awake all 24 hours. And these activities are simultaneous. And if you only reach from one to the other, you are performing a creative act.
What starts to happen are these memory cascades. So, for example, if you're walking somewhere and suddenly somebody passes and they're wearing some Chantilly, some perfume that maybe your Aunt Louise wore, for a moment as they pass, this whole other time in your life appears before you. And if you, and then it passes, then you just go back to your regular thinking. But if you could stop that moment, one of the things you'd realize is it's not just a picture of your Aunt Louise's kitchen. You can turn around in that image. And not only that, if you ask yourself, you'll notice there's a time of day, there's a season, there's all the elements that need to be there for you to actually write a scene. And this happens all day long. Even when you're just seeing like somebody dropped a Band-Aid on the outside of an elevator, there's a moment when you'll see it and have some memory, even if it's fleeting, of a Band-Aid. It's not you having that memory. It's what you were saying. That stuff's going on all the time. And this other kind of day-to-day thinking is the thinking that's the unreal thinking. You know, that hamster wheel thinking, I have to do this and I have to do that and I have to do that. That isn't, to me, that's not the real being or the real thinking. It feels like it is, but there's this other world, this whole other ongoing world, just like you said. And that's what, in a way, comics are a perfect way to access that because they're so fast. You can do it so quickly.
Well, I'm not sure how far I'll get, but I can't wait to start. I have monsters twitching in my fingertips. They just can't wait. Now,
look at that sentence. I have monsters twitching in my fingertips. They just can't wait. Right? It almost doesn't matter what you draw under that caption. That goes with every picture, that sentence.
Well, it's fascinating because you mentioned, I want to hear about Ivan Brunetti.
So Ivan Brunetti has identified a quick drawing style that's an alternative to stick men, because the problem with stick men is they can't bend their arms, they can't bend their legs, they can't eat They can't really do anything. So Brunetti actually takes, it's mostly the way kids draw. So it's a really big head, big round head, because there's lots of room for features. The body is sort of almost like a wedge of cheese if you cut off the pointy part, or any kind of shape, a triangle or rectangle, but just so there's a shape underneath. And then the arms have curves, sort of like noodles. And so one of the problems people have with comics is they try to draw anatomically correct. So they'll try to do elbows and knees. But if you just have noodles, and then a lot of the drawing instructions I get are from my 4 and 5 year olds. I'll tell them, well, my university students don't know how to draw hands. And they'll go, oh, hands are easy. It's a snowball, thumb, 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 thumb. And sure enough, draw a snowball with 5 thumbs. It looks like a hand. Or an ear. People don't know how to draw ears. My 4-year-olds will say, that's easy. It's the letter C with a 5 in it. Or a backward C with a question mark in it. And you see that these little symbols come together, and suddenly you have a character that can move and walk and do everything you need it to do in the world.
I love you.
I love you too. Little hearts are flying out of my
yes,
eyes.
Me too. It's like one of those, this is our first encounter, and I want you to give me my first monster lesson. But what can I say except I'm Michael Silverblatt. I'm talking with Linda Barry, author of Making Comics, published by Drawn and Quarterly. I hope you've enjoyed our time as much as we did. Thank you for joining me, Linda.
Oh, it's been such a delight.
I think that's the first time that's ever happened. I'm not going to try and do it back. I'm not. I did. You can visit kcrw.com/bookworm for a podcast of today's show. Also available at Apple, Spotify, and all podcast services. You can even listen on demand with KCRW's own smartphone apps. Special thanks to my co-producer, Sean Sullivan, Alan Howard, associate producer, the technical director, Mario Diaz. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm. I'm never going to live that down.
I am a bookworm, he is a bookworm, she is a bookworm, we are all bookworms. I am a bookworm, we are all bookworms.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. You can access archives of all Bookworm programs and podcasts, the most recent ones, at kcrw.com/bookworm. The Bookworm themes were composed and performed by Ron and Russell Mayle of Sparks.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm when Ocean Vuong is our guest.